There once was a drug czar named Bennett, whose every remark was a tenet. His pomposity plus his hypocrisy outweighed the United States Senate. Won't you come home, Bill Bennett? This piece was written by Fred Gardner, the great friend and former assistant to one of tonight's guests, District Attorney Terrence Hallinan. So William Bennett is a big-time compulsive gambler who holes up at casinos for three-day binges. Perfect. And his social poker game includes judges Scalia, Bork, and the chief junkie, Rehnquist. In case you missed it, in the last decade, the former drug czar has blown at least $8 million at the tables and slot machines. Profits from his book, The Book of Virtues, and its many best-selling spin-offs, plus $50,000 speaking fees, enabled him to pay. Bennett's vicious stint as drug czar is described in Smoke and Mirrors, an excellent history of the war on drugs from the 60s through the mid-90s by Dan Baum. Bennett brought with him a squad of right-wing ideologues who served him at the Department of Education, including his chief of staff, John Walters, our current drug czar. Bennett's crew, according to Baum, achieved the most radical recasting of the country's drug problem yet. Drugs would no longer be discussed as a health problem. If the drug issue was going to serve the Bennettistas' decade-long crusade to police the nation's character, drug abuse needed to be placed in the same category as offensive art, multicultural teaching, and ethical relativism, a matter of morality. The piece is much more in-depth, but you can read the whole article and more than 100,000 more that show the hypocrisy of this drug war at mapinc.org. That's MAPINC.org. This is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. I am Dean Becker, your host. Steve Nolan, our engineer, is at the controls. Cheryl, Tammy, and Dwayne are manning the phones and computers, and we're thrilled that you're with us here tonight. This is our second special about the recent conference for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws that was held at the end of last month in San Francisco. The hypocrisy of this drug war is enormous, costly, wasteful, unconstitutional, and just plain wicked and evil. I've spent the last 2 weeks contacting every elected official I could think of in the state of Texas or in Harris County or Houston to come on this show and talk with our District Attorney Terrence Hallinan. Not one of them dares to sit before these open mics I have next to me and explain to you why they do what they do in this drug war. Why do they send 17-year-olds to prison for having a good time with marijuana? The lessons learned in prison, sodomy lessons, violent criminal training, and permanent behavior modification. This is surely not the best answer to the use of a plant that has never killed anyone in its 8,000-year history. Former drug czar Bill Bennett and his protege, the current czar John Walters, are perfect examples of imperfection. They represent the high and mighty, the moralists, the supposed Christians who believe their understanding, their morals, have precedence and priority over the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Declaration of Independence. Bennett actually told the Washington Post that his gambling habit started out with church bingo. So obviously, church bingo is the gateway to multi-million-dollar gambling habits. Okay, that's about it for the news slash editorial for tonight. I urge you to listen Monday through Saturday to the 420 Drug War News right here on KPFT, where we report the national and international drug war news somewhere around 420 each afternoon. I'm proud to introduce my first guest for the evening with a little help from Keith Straub of Normal, as recorded at the San Francisco conference. Welcome, Mr. Hallinan. Welcome to Cultural Baggage. Do you hear us, sir?
Glad to be with you.
Well, thank you, sir. Yes, sir. I already miss San Francisco. It's a wonderful town out there.
A great city.
Yes.
Great people.
I agree. I was born there, and darn it, I should have just stayed. yes, sir. I don't know how much chance you get to hear the news from Texas, but I'm hoping that you've heard of the Tulia scandal, the Dallas Sheetrock scandal, the Houston Crime Lab.
No, I don't know of those.
Well, I'll brief you quickly on what I think is the most gregarious of them, outrageous of them, and it's the Tulia scandal, where they arrested 39 black people in one night, all for cocaine charges, though when they made the arrest, no drugs, no weapons, no money was found.
Yeah, I remember reading of that, now that you mentioned it.
Yes, sir, and the recent happenings with it is that a gentleman, Tom Coleman, who was the sole support for all these arrests, he had no backup whatsoever except what he had written on his leg, and he was indicted for perjury. And yet it seems now they're going to take months, if not years, to let the people go that are in prison based on his testimony.
Uh-huh.
It's people
he's convicted in the past, you mean?
Yes, sir. And they can't seem to figure out how to get them out of jail.
Yeah, difficult.
Yes, sir. I realize it's a Texas matter. I probably should stick to medical marijuana, which I think we both have a great understanding of. I first off want to tell you how grateful I am for your efforts to share the truth in regards to medical marijuana, and your speech at the Normal conference was just wonderful.
Well, thank you, Dean.
Yes, sir.
And of course, I've seen the truth of it here in San Francisco, where everybody in this city knows somebody who swears their life is being prolonged by the use of marijuana.
Yes, sir, and I have seen instances of it. There are certain people where it's just so obvious, like people with multiple sclerosis.
The people in some of the clubs or clinics, whatever you want to call them, there's no question they're full of sick people. You know.
Yes, sir. I work hard here in Houston. Me and most of the crew in here at this show with me, we work together to try to bring drug reform to Houston. It's tough going here.
Yeah, it's a tough town.
Yes, sir. And I wonder if you could share with my listeners some of the beginnings, what you may recall that made it possible in San Francisco and in California.
For me personally, back a long time ago, let's see, the early 80s, an activist in this community named Dennis Perron, wonderful guy, put an initiative on the ballot for the San Francisco voters to have an opportunity to vote on what they thought about medical marijuana, and 80% of them voted in favor of it. And under our charter, when that happens, then it's the responsibility of the Board of Supervisors to do something to follow through on it, which I undertook to do. And we had a hearing on medical marijuana, which was one of the most amazing things I've ever attended. A police commissioner undergoing chemotherapy, 3 of the 10 people still receiving legal marijuana for having contracted AIDS through blood transfusions for leukemia. People after people, experts, doctors, scientists, testifying about the medical effectiveness of it. When they got through, there wasn't a dry house in the committee room.
Yes, sir. And here in Texas, we don't have the opportunity to do a referendum, a people sponsored. You know, you got to fight.
Wait, there is no referendum there.
Well, not a direct referendum.
Or initiative we're talking about, right?
Well, initiative, yes, sir. Yeah, you have to fight directly through the legislature. To have them offer up or create a bill. It makes it tough.
That's an interesting state of yours down there.
Yes, sir, it is.
And you're a San Francisco guy who left here and picked up a Texas accent, huh?
Well, my dad was with the oil company, so we moved around a lot, and I wound up down here. But been here 30-something years. But
Well, it sounds like you're doing a good job in a tough place. I mean, I admire your courage.
We're brave souls. This whole crew.
Is marijuana still a felony down there in Texas?
Well, it can be if you get over 4 ounces.
Ounces. Well, that's not that bad.
Well,
I mean, some places in Nevada, it's a straight felony, you know.
Right. Well, I guess the whole point of it is even the police have a little discretion. It depends how much you piss them off, I guess, before they'll... You know, how you mess up their evening, I suppose.
Yeah, you definitely have to be on your P's and Q's at certain times in your life when you're around police officers, that's for sure.
Yes, sir. I want to ask you if, you look back at the time, I guess, before Dennis Perron came up with that. San Francisco was still probably a more forgiving city than most of in America, even before that.
This is a wonderful city. This is a second chance city. You know, everybody came here, what, gold miners and sailors and Chinese to work on the railways, and mostly all men came here adventurers and with tolerance, and that stuck with us. And then, of course, we have this great big labor union movement out here compared to other places, so that's given it a nice, solid base.
Yes, sir. I don't know how much of my earlier editorial you got to hear, but I was talking about the fact that I had contacted... I wanted to have a counterpoint for when you came on the show, you know, a local politician, representative of some kind, to discuss the situation. And, of course, I couldn't get anybody to come on board. How does one...
I heard you say that.
How does one breach, you know, broach that subject or create that bridge with these politicians?
Their constituents, you know. Anybody who's elected knows they're elected by their constituents. And if they get some kind of pressure from within the people who elect them, they will respond to it. Phone calls have an impact. You know, you come in your office and the secretary says, hey, there were 100 people phoned today on that bill you're working on. You're going to take it different. You're going to pay more attention to it. Letter writings, delegations, you know, target in on some legislative body you want to affect and go to work on them.
Yes, sir. I think we will do that. I want to run just a quick interview we did at the conference. Just 1 minute here. I wonder, what's your take? Is this... are we making progress?
I think the progress this year will mostly come not at the legal or illegal, but at the what's the actual consequences of an arrest level. As states are discovering that they've got bottomless pits in their budget, they're looking for things they can cut. And one of the least painful places to cut is the criminal justice system's application to dumb laws.
While we were in San Francisco for the normal conference, the U.S. government's new legislation, the RAVE Act, was passed, which calls for the indictment of any venue which allows drugs to be used on its property, and in particular calls for the forfeiture of said property.
Now, I think it was a brilliant move setting the Hyatt Corporation up to be the first defendant under the new RAVE Act.
In that thousands of joints were smoked at this normal conference, in the open, at the Hyatt Regency, Ben Mazel may just be right.
Now, that was a little tongue-in-cheek, I suppose. But, you know, the point of it is that how does one justify, you know, two sets of laws? It seems like, isn't there sort of, some sort of double jeopardy involved? The federal government supposedly has precedents, but you can't get those guys to stand for an open debate.
Ordinarily, they do have precedence, but there has to be some, or there should be some link or nexus to give the federal government some business in that area. Now, they contend with marijuana, for example, that it crosses a state boundary lines, but we know most marijuana in California is grown in California, but that doesn't seem to bother them.
Yeah, the truth shouldn't matter. They don't let truth get in the way of their dealings. Another gentleman I don't know if you got to hear at the conference, but a great mind helped put together that Canadian report on legal marijuana, Senator Nolan. Let's just hear a little bit.
I missed that.
Let's have a little bit from him.
You heard me this morning talking a lot about fundamental values, protection of liberties and freedom. For us, it's the cornerstone of our thinking. For me, as Canadian, to knowing the importance of your Bill of Rights, I don't understand why you have so much an harassment not to be able to have those fundamental rights and liberties promoted and defended by the court.
And Mr. Hallinan, I think...
Yeah, and they don't even have a Bill of Rights.
No, but they have the human... I'm sorry, I can't think of the term, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's not in their constitution like ours, yet, as he points out there in Canada, they have a better attitude towards many things like drugs than we do.
Well, and look what happened to Ed Rosenthal, which just disturbs the heck out of me that whatever happened to the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? When we start excluding it like they did at Ed's trial and many of the other medical patients, that's not America in my book.
Yeah, that was terrible.
Yes, sir.
Fortunately, the states are ahead of the federal government on that issue.
Yes, sir, they are. And Ed has the an army behind him there in California. I'm real happy to know that all y'all are standing together out there.
Yeah, well, he's facing sentencing before federal court not far from now, and he could go to prison for 20 years.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to take a little quick break, and then we're going to bring in our other guest for the evening, Dr. Thomas J. O'Connell. Let's go ahead and run those, Steve.
And the war on drugs has warped judicial neutrality and constitutional law. The judge made drug exceptions to every precious constitutional right, including rights that would seem to have very little to do with drugs, such as the First Amendment's guarantee of religious liberty. So religious freedom remains one of the many constitutional rights that have become casualties of the war on drugs.
I've always been certain that drug prohibition would fall eventually simply because it was built on ignorance and it requires ignorance to survive. And in the information age, you have to have information. Information goes everywhere. And if information goes everywhere, then that means eventually at some point people will be educated. And when people are educated, well, the story is pretty astounding. And the evidence against the policy is so astounding. I mean, it's as if we were basing our space program on the belief that the Earth is flat. It is that far out of touch with the evidence. And it is a holdover. It is the modern equivalent of burning witches. I mean, it is that far behind in its mentality and its connection to science.
Okay, that was Cliff Schaefer talking about, you know, the need to deal with the truth and the reality of it. I think we have Dr. Tom O'Connell on the line. Can you hear us, Tom?
I can, Dean. Good evening.
Good evening, sir. Thank you for joining us. Can you guys hear each other?
Yeah, I can hear Dr. O'Connell.
Well, good. We're set then. Dr. Tom, we were talking about, you know, the need for compassion, the need to look at the truth of all this. What have you found? I understand you're doing an ongoing study of medical patients out there. What are some of the preliminary indications?
Well, Dean, I've started seeing patients about 15 months ago in November of 2001, and I had the advantage of approaching this with very few preconceptions because I came of age long before pot had reached American high schools, and I'd had no experience with it. What I did have was a conviction that the drug war was seriously flawed, and I'd been an activist for about 6 years, but I'd had no experience with either using pot myself or dealing with patients who were using it. So it gave me a unique perspective. And
yes, sir, we did some recordings while I was out there, and I've played segments from it on several of my newscasts, and I've gotten a lot of response. The numbers, the dabbling, if you will, in other drugs that the medical marijuana users tend to do and then come back to using just the medical marijuana are astounding. Could you discuss some of those numbers?
Yeah, the first thing that I discovered was that everybody I was seeing had been using for years. And when I questioned them about how they were using, I found it was a very regular pattern, which was the opposite of recreational use. It was clearly self-medication. So that made me ask them about other drugs that they might have used. And I found that they'd all tried alcohol and essentially all had tried tobacco. And when we asked about other drugs, we found that their so-called initiation rates were astounding. So this was a population that had come to try drugs very aggressively at a very young age, really starting in junior high school or the middle of high school for most of them.
Yes, sir. And Mr. Hallinan, if I may ask, you know, he's talking talking about medical marijuana users. I mean, I realize that people that are up too long on speed or down too long on heroin can become a public nuisance.
Although usually when they stop, then that stops too. The heroin is a different problem because of the need to get the money for addictions, although I guess that applies to crack too.
Well, sure, and if it were legal, the ramifications of, you know, if it costs a penny on the dollar would be a whole lot less.
Yeah, well, they do that in Switzerland, I believe.
Yes, sir. Dealing with looking at the law enforcement side, you don't get calls for domestic abuse or whatever for marijuana users, I wouldn't think.
No, I definitely don't expect the combination of those two things, although, it's possible.
Well, at random, a situation could develop, but it's not a trend, I wouldn't think.
No, the alcohol is the main one, and then crack cocaine.
Well, Tom, let me ask you this. If your study proves what you're saying, that this is more like a cycle that these medical marijuana users do, that they go through to, if you will, mature and come to the conclusion that the medical marijuana is the right medicine to help with their pain, their anxiety, their stress, what kind of response is this to the authorities that say it leads to criminality, insanity, and death?
Well, Dean, there are no clinical studies that demonstrate this at all.
Yes,
the clinical evidence is lacking. These are assertions that are conjured up by somebody's imagination. And
Go
ahead, Terry.
I was just going to say what Dr. O'Connell.
Yes, sir.
Said about people clearly self-medicating definitely strikes a bell with me. My experience seems to indicate that anybody who's been a long-term marijuana user, or a great number of the people are dealing with some kind of painful thing in their life that they use marijuana to deal with. Arthritis or an old injury or something along that line. Otherwise, it's something people do and give up. But when people stick for it for a long time, it seems to me there's some kind of underlying medical problem there.
Well, actually, Terry, a lot of them have severe pain, but in many cases, their emotional pain predated that. And when you take careful histories from them,
I could accept that. And under our Proposition 215, that's one of the bases for recommending marijuana.
That's an important point. California is the only state that permits a physician to use that judgment.
Uh-huh.
In most other states, they're roped into certain specific physical diagnoses, and psychotropic use is pretty much ruled out.
California is... Proposition 215 is really a very broad...
The most open-ended.
He says if a doctor says it will help you, you can use it.
So that makes California, in my opinion, a very important laboratory to see exactly how patients are using cannabis medically.
Well, I know you Texas guys like to think of yourselves as the top of the cake, but we like to think the trends start in California.
Well, sure. I have to agree with that. I mean, I feel like I should go out there and, get a job and just shake off the blues of Texas here. But then again, if we didn't hang in and do this show, I don't know what would happen in this town. We need to make a change happen.
And I remember many years ago, I spent some time in Texas and Austin and San Antonio and Houston and I thought that was a great state.
Well, now it is, sir, in many ways. But
I know some, on like some legal things and prohibitions and so on, they're pretty backward. But
well, let me relate to you, gentlemen. I had to go to a local municipal court. My son had been delinquent twice, and while we're waiting for our turn to go before the judge, they bring in a string about a dozen 17 to 20 year old, mostly Mexican and black males. I think out of the 12 or so that came in, 10 of them were there for minor amounts of marijuana. And, it's just outrageous, the waste of taxpayer dollars, the lack of real concern for public safety when those officers could have been chasing down a rapist or a murderer or a, you know, a child molester instead.
Well, you know, even here in San Francisco, we've been we've recently been looking over our jail population because of these budget cuts forcing us to deal with maybe we have to close some jails down. And even in San Francisco, there are a huge number of people in for marijuana. I was shocked at it.
Yes, sir. That surprises me as well.
Often in connection with another offense, possession for sale, or they're picked up for something and then marijuana ends up being what they're held for. I was pretty surprised, and I know my chief assistant, she goes, oh, no, that won't be in there. I go, look at it. Take a look at it.
Well, maybe. Maybe you need to talk to him.
Well, I think when we start deciding who is going to get out of jail pending trial, who we can take a risk on, those will be on the front of the list.
Right. Dr. O'Connell, I understand that for years you helped publish the DrugSense newsletter. And,
yes.
And I was wondering if you would tell the listeners about that opportunity to learn where they might be able to hook up with that information.
Well, the newsletter is a part of an organization called mapinc.org, www.mapinc.org, and it was founded in 97 as an internet organization to promote letters to the editor from people with a particular interest in drug policy. And as part of that effort, to a remarkable archive, which now contains over 100,000 items, all searchable with an excellent search engine. So any journalist who's writing seriously about the war on drugs finds MAP an indispensable asset or thing that they have to use.
Well, sure.
And you're out here in the Bay Area, right, Dr. O'Connell?
I'm in San Mateo, Terry.
Now, you guys have the good weather. I was hearing that it was getting a little chilly and colder out there. And
we've been having so much rain, it's unbelievable.
But we've yet to really have a spring.
Unbelievable.
Well, we're already starting summer, guys.
So. Almost summer.
Yeah. Let me ask you both, then. If... You know, given the chance, if I could get you guys to come here to Houston and help me stir the pot, find the right judge or representative to talk to, what's the first thing I need to tell them? What do we need to do to get off this pot, if you know what I mean?
Find an elected official and who... Who you must be able to find somebody down there who has some kind of a tolerance, and then just start working on them and expand from there.
Tom?
I think that the one issue that the public understands clearly is medical marijuana.
Absolutely.
Is that this is used medically. And I think that makes it the obvious beginning, that when you can convince a significant number of people. Prop 215 passed in 1996, so despite 3 ex-presidents and all kinds of other politicians speaking against it, precisely because patients knew it worked and families knew it worked. And most people had known of a user and were convinced. So public support was overwhelming, and it's grown since then.
I think it's wonderful advice from both of you. And I guess the main point here is there's still so much deep-seated fear. It's hard to... I must admit, I think I've passed most of that I'm able to talk to these people about it. It's the fear of the representatives of the elected to say the first word, to be the first one. And you talk to them or their aides, they all agree, yes, it needs doing, we'll help, but we can't initiate it.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the problem. I'm trying to alert the listeners through my news shows and this show to, you know, to write their elected officials to do and say something to help get it done. And I think incrementally it's happening. But,
and I agree with Dr. O'Connell. The medical marijuana is definitely the issue.
All right. I will take that certainly under advisement with all my future efforts. I think you're absolutely right. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, We want to get your calls. Our number here is 713-526-5738. Our guests are District Attorney of San Francisco, Terrence Hallinan, and Dr. Thomas J. O'Connell. And we're going to go right now to the Activist Corner with Steve Nolan.
Thanks, Dean. We got a couple of things coming up on the calendar, so you can go out and help us change these laws. Coming up next week on the 15th, Houston Normal will be having their monthly meeting. It'll be at Chapultepec Mexican Restaurant, which is located at 813 Richmond. That'll be Thursday, May 15th, starting at 7:30 p.m. Then coming up the following Monday, the Drug Policy Forum of Texas will be having their monthly meeting. That'll be the 19th. It's going to be starting at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church on South Moore and Fannin. Once again, that's going to be starting at 7 o'clock. And tomorrow at 1 p.m., they'll be having the Art Car Parade. KPFT has a newly painted art car. And so come out and support the Free Speech Radio, listener-supported, that brings you all this exciting news as far as the drug war and what you can do to change it. And one note, last weekend they had the March for Marijuana in Austin, and I got a report from Sarah that they had about 300 people come out to march on the Capitol up in Austin. Our Texas Normal president, Mark Stepnoski, gave a speech out there, so it was a really good turnout. That's about it for the Activist Corner. Back to you, Dean.
Thank you, Steve. Folks, we want you to give us a call here, 713-526-5738. It's a chance to talk to District Attorney Terrence Hallinan and Dr. Thomas J. O'Connell. Okay, gentlemen, I'm looking at some of the news that, you know, the states are going broke, but these politicians still seem to want to hang on to this drug war, you know, like it's their mother's milk. They're just unwilling to let go. And I see, like in Rhode Island, they're now allowing evictions for drug possession. You know, that landlords will have the right to kick people out of their house if they are caught with a joint, you know, in the same city, I suppose. And, you know, it just goes on. It's some sort of, Cliff Schaefer alluded to it. It's like basing our space program on the thought that the Earth is flat. You know, it's just not making any sense. The Prop 36 in California, has that been a success, Mr. Hallinan?
It has been a success. It's been a varying success in some places better than others. In San Francisco, we already had so many programs in place that it hasn't caught on as well as in some other areas. But in most other areas, it is being used to the fullest extent, and it has really, taken begin the process of taking drugs out of the criminal justice system.
Yes, sir. And,
to my mind, that's a goal we should have.
Well, sure. The destruction we create with prohibition is just unbelievable. Dr. O'Connell, the medical marijuana patients you deal with, for the most part, these people are not a threat to society. They're not criminals in any regard other than under federal law. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. They are all either working or looking for work. I mean, they're ordinary people. And for most of them, their use of cannabis is what allows them to work. It facilitates their lives. And, they're the very opposite of criminals.
I agree with that, sir. It's been my experience as well. When you talk to these patients, you say you're developing a database. Do you have an idea of about how many you've questioned at this point?
I've personally seen about just short of 2,000.
That's going to be a significant
number. Some of them are so-called renewals, because one of the requirements is that this has to be renewed every year. It's also a requirement of the medical board. So we get to... And it was interesting for me, because the first group I saw, where I was quite clueless. I didn't know about the things I know now. So when I had a second opportunity to see these patients, I find out that they really fit the profile I had established in the interim. I just didn't know it the first time around. So it was interesting confirmation of what I'm finding.
Are you in private practice, doctor?
I'm pretty much retired. I was a chest surgeon. And
Good for you.
I still have my license, and this is my practice now. I see about 30 of these patients a week.
Good for you. You have courage. Because it does take courage for a doctor to...
Well, actually, less for me than for some of the others, because I think that we were protected by the Supreme Court on a free speech or a First Amendment basis. And since we're not selling or growing, I think we stand very little risk of interference from the feds.
Well, keep your fingers crossed and hope the Supreme Court doesn't change.
I do.
I heard that Dr. Grinspoon actually had some problem with, I don't know, Harvard Medical Board or some such.
Oh, is he actually the New England Medical Society?
Yes, sir. They had tried to impugn his name somehow.
An anti-pot activist named Calvina Fay.
Oh, that, yes.
Wrote a letter to the medical board, and she said that because he had recommended patients use cannabis, because he admitted that he used it himself, she thought his license should be removed. And they held a hearing, and they decided not to have a hearing, and they sort of declined to remove his license, but they didn't exonerate him completely either. It was a very disappointing ruling to me, but he's still licensed.
He's quite a nice guy. When he was out here in San Francisco a few months back, I took him on a tour of some of our clinic buyers clubs, and he was really knocked out.
Lester is a very honest man. He started out to write an article about the evils of marijuana back in 1968, and after he did his research, he realized that marijuana had been slandered, so he wrote an article to that effect. And the rest is history.
Yeah, well, he started in working for the federal government, right?
Well, he had been basically on their side. He was actually an editor of a journal, where he was editing a book, and he had some spare time, so he decided to knock out this marijuana article. And that was the first time he had ever studied it. And what he realized was that the case that the federal government had made against it was wrong.
That's as simple as it looks, yeah.
Another instance of Saul turning into Paul, if you will. Another one that I'm aware of is Eric Sterling, who used to help write the laws of prohibition, and has now come full circle to be a great reformer.
Yeah, I've heard Eric apologize for his role in toughening the drug laws under Tip O'Neill. He was an administrative assistant for Congress during that era, and he keeps apologizing for it.
Well, he's more than compensated, I guess, at this point. But you stop and think.
As far as I'm concerned, that whole Congress should apologize for not doing something more reasonable with relationship to marijuana.
Well, certainly, sir. There's so few that are willing to speak up, even at that level. Ron Paul is one of the few that's been willing to stand for medical marijuana.
Well, Barney Frank.
Oh, yes.
Is a good guy too.
No, this is quite true, and I don't know. I mean, even among reformers, some call me radical, but I think the time will come when the last few clinging to these drug war laws should be seen as war criminals, because the damage done has just been tremendous.
I'll settle for him just being viewed as wrong.
That's perhaps more realistic.
Well, I stress that I'm seen as radical. Now, I understand you take that thought with a grain of salt. We're going to run one more clip here, and then we're going to take some calls.
George W. Bush and suppression of medical cannabis is killing vastly more people and causing vastly more human suffering than even Saddam Hussein could in his worst days. And this is something that the cannabis movement and the peace movement and progressive people every place have to address. People in the who are protesting and being in favor of doing something about poverty in the third world, if they aren't addressing medical cannabis, they are ignoring something that has an enormous impact on millions of people. And a lot of them think, oh, I can't talk about cannabis because I'm too too serious. Well, if they're too serious to, you know, they can't talk about mass murder, then they have their priorities all screwed up. And that really was my basic point to them there. And the cannabis movement and progressive people every place need to address this issue.
Okay, that was Richard Cowan, writes for medicalmarijuananews.com, or marijuananews.com. And I think he makes a very strong point. I mean, he kind of backs up my contention that there are lives being destroyed because of these marijuana laws.
Yeah, there's no question about that. There are thousands of people in prison in the United States.
Yes, sir. And people who can't afford these prescription drugs that, you know, otherwise just have to suffer and or, you know, lose work time or, you know, time that they could be spending with their family or whatever, spend it in agony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some people claim there's no prescription drug that will do some of the things that marijuana does.
I agree with that completely. It's much more effective than Paxil and Prozac, certainly, for most people who use it. Many of them have been on it and have discontinued those in favor of marijuana.
Yeah, that's what I understand, all right. Some people really swear by it, you know.
I think the point that Dean makes, that the drug war is lethal for a lot of people, and it's not just, of course, not just marijuana users, that it's got so many ramifications. So,
well, the 40-year-old war in Colombia, for one, where we chop
exactly
at 3,500 minimum people every year, and for what? And it has certainly hasn't been won.
And the Colombian economy is in collapse because illegal drug profits are the main source of foreign exchange, and no one else wants to invest in the country anymore. It's so ridden by crime. It's divided by revolution. It can't attract foreign capital. And the same is true of every drug-producing nation in the world.
Yeah, well, of course it is. It just takes over a country, and it does destroy it.
In fact, it's the principal reason that Afghanistan was available to Osama bin Laden, because of the international heroin trade that originates there and which has commandeered their economy.
Yeah, and now that the war is over, it's back up to the world's leading producer of the opium.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the CIA helped them start their opium business back in 1980. It was part of our master plan for ejecting the Russians.
Hmm. Boy. Well, let me see. They're telling me we have a caller? Or no?
Yes.
Okay. Hello, caller. Can you hear me?
Yes. At this point, I am interested about, I've been following Ed Rosenthal's trial, and I'd like to get a forecast from your guest on what the outcome will be on the Senate thing that's coming up here next month.
On the Senate thing?
Yes, sir. Again,
the sentencing, you mean?
For Ed Rosenthal, yes.
I'm sorry. He, I believe that that the judge will deviate from the mandatory minimums, that he won't go with the mandatory minimums. But I also believe that Ed does face some jail prison time. And, you know, and anybody who knows that judge, whose brother, of course, on the Supreme Court, should just let him know to give him probation. But I think that, I'll be surprised if he gets that.
I'm assuming this is going to sort of propel more and more people to get involved.
Hopefully. Certainly got those jurors involved.
Mr. Hallahan, you're one of my heroes. It seems like that there's going to be more and more people that are going to get outraged. It seems like Mr. Rosenthal is just being turned into a sacrificial lamb or something like that.
Well, he certainly was working, producing marijuana for the medical marijuana community. He even had a permit from the city of Oakland to do it, and all that was not allowed to be told to the jury.
One of the things that I find really amazing about that trial is that one of the people who provided key testimony against Ed operates a club, and he had to testify under duress that he had bought marijuana from Ed for his club. And he's still operating his club.
Yeah, they found his check, and he had to account for what the check was for.
Which is remarkable. The federal government is clearly clearly waging sort of an opportunistic guerrilla war against the program of against 215 in California, and they've been nibbling away at the margins of the Bay Area. And I agree that whatever happens to Ed is going to be pivotal for the future, because there are several other trials that are going to be that are pending.
Yeah, it certainly will be. And if the judge does give him a good break, that will, you know, that will be a good thing from the point of view of the medical marijuana community.
Let me interrupt right quick. Caller, listen in here. This is a little discussion I had with Ed Rosenthal out in San Francisco a couple of weeks back.
Most people don't realize that Prop 215, the Medical Marijuana Initiative, is running full blast here in San Francisco. In the Bay Area here, there are more than 30 dispensaries, and over 30,000 people have either registered or are taking advantage of Prop 215, which allows for medical use of marijuana with a doctor's recommendation.
So given this circumstance of support here, what can other cities and states do? How can they learn to become cohesive without getting stopped along the way?
Jim, you're asking how do you develop an activist movement and a movement that actually provides services to people in a hostile environment. Here in the San Francisco Bay Area, we're very lucky because we had an environment in which the people understood what the situation was and how helpful marijuana could be for medical conditions. And usually the police are actually pretty understanding about it once they understand that what you're trying to do is promote a controlled, regulated market for medicine.
Dwayne's the caller. I hope that tells you a little bit about Ed's attitude. That's the man who's on the bubble, who's, as Mr. Hallinan said, perhaps going to jail, and he's still standing tall before these federal authorities.
One last parting shot. Do you have any comments on what's happening in Canada? Because I do look at cannabis news on a daily basis, and it looks like cannabis is going to really put the bug in Uncle Sam's eye because of the pending legislation to really legalize minor amounts of cannabis in Canada. Any comment on that from either of the guests, please?
I only know that they're in the process of doing that, of basically legalizing personal possession of small amounts of marijuana. They're also in the process of extending amnesty to several people who have medical marijuana activists who've left this country with warrants following them.
Well, that would be Mr. Kuby and some of the others. That,
Rene Bouger.
Steve, yes. Cubby, Rene Bouger, Ken Hayes.
Ken Hayes, of course.
Right, and if I recall, Mr. Cubby was actually going before a UN review board, an immigration board or something, to see if the laws of the United States were too draconian and if he should just be allowed to stay to avoid those penalties.
The decision on that is pending. He's had his hearing a few weeks ago, and I think their decision is pending. Most people expect him to be allowed to stay, but whether he'll be given refugee status, I'm not sure. The Canadians are moving forward, but they're moving forward at a very glacial rate of speed, and that's probably because their arm is being twisted behind the scenes by, and actually to some extent out in the open, by John Walters and other American officials.
Bennett's protege, yes.
Yeah, I think there's no question about that. Dean, I got to go.
I understand,
Dr. O'Connell,
sir.
It was real nice talking to you, and keep up the good work.
Thanks very much, Terrence. You too.
Mr. Hallinan, thank you so much. We'll talk to you someday soon, I hope.
Okay, Dean.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, Dr. Tom, I wanted to kind of reach back to your perhaps your early years as a doctor. You worked in treating Vietnam veterans, I guess, during the war.
Actually, they were casualties.
I'm sorry, you're right.
I was stationed in Japan from 1963 to 1967, and starting in late 65, we began to receive casualties from Vietnam, and by the time I returned to the States in 67, that was a steady stream. Japan became the major offshore medical support facility for the war.
Yes, and you see these young lives ruined by war And yet, we've ruined a lot more with this drug war, wouldn't you say?
Well, the interesting thing is I'm seeing a lot of the patients that use medical marijuana are Vietnam veterans, and they're now in their early 50s. And many of them are using it for post-traumatic stress disorder. Their incidence of hepatitis C is three times the national average.
Yes, sir.
They were a very stressed generation. They're also the generation that coincided with the arrival of pot in American high schools. The pot market was non-existent until about 1965. And after 1967, at least in the Bay Area, pot hit all the high schools, and it's been there ever since.
I think I was right on the cusp of that. I graduated 66. There was one guy busted that year, you know, my last year in school. And I had never seen it. I had to go to Mexico to find it. You know, I didn't know where it, just heard about it. Dr. O'Connell, we're going to be running out of time here soon. I want to kind of give you free rein. Are there some things that, you know, we should realize here that my listeners should know that it's possible to make a difference? You know, tell them what it's like in San Francisco. They hear me say it, and perhaps they won't believe me. What have you been able to, you know, what makes California so special?
Oh, I'm not sure I know, Dean. It's where everything seems to happen first, at least socially. And San Francisco is actually a lot different than Southern California. And it's a very, has always been a very tolerant community. Although, interestingly, it was the first place in the United States where they passed opium laws that were aimed at the Chinese back in 1875, but they've become a lot more liberal since then. And the function of the law, in fact, the San Francisco Department of Health identifies patients with a card. If they bring their recommendation to the health department, it's validated. They pay $25 and they get a plastic card which identifies them as a patient. And the health department maintains that registry. So it's a quite a different community than most. Even outside San Mateo County, where I live, has no distribution clubs, nor to my knowledge to San Jose.
And you're within what distance of San Francisco?
Pardon me? Well, I'm 15 miles from the city.
Wow.
So we're the county immediately to the south.
Yes. So, okay.
Marin County immediately to the north has one club, which it... Very, you know, it treats with a great deal of caution and
right.
Tries to restrain it. Whereas Oakland, there are numerous clubs on the east side of the bay. So even within our region, there's considerable variation in the tolerance of law enforcement for this proposition, for this initiative.
Yes, sir. I also want to thank you for joining us tonight. Dr. Tom, I'd like to do this again, you know, perhaps a little bit further down the line where we can discuss more in depth your findings from your ongoing study.
Dr. McAria, who you talked to about earlier, and a journalist named Fred Gardner,
yes,
have gotten together, and they're putting out a local medical journal called O'Shaughnessy's. It's named after Dr. O'Shaughnessy, who introduced Western medicine. He was a British physician working in India.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought medical marijuana, actually, to the British Isles in 1839. He introduced it. So that journal is going to be named in his honor. And the first issue should be out in about 2 weeks.
Will that actually be online, or?
I'm not sure, but it will make interesting reading. I've seen the galleys.
Well, will you be sure to get me a copy or tell me how to acquire
one? I certainly will.
I definitely want to stay involved with that. There's much we can learn from what you guys have accomplished out there and what you're learning at this time. And
the idea of this journal is to give people a place to publish their results.
Good, good. That's all, like you said, you need to give California time to go through the learning curve, to prove what it can and let the rest of the world share from those results, right?
Yeah, it would be the first time in our history that we'd have an evidence-based marijuana policy. If these findings were acted upon, or at least read, we'd have an opportunity for an evidence-based policy.
Yes, sir.
Instead of one based on witchcraft.
Really. So true. Well, Dr. O'Connell, I guess that's it for tonight. I thank you so much, and we'll be talking to you in the near future.
Dean, the pleasure's all mine. Good night.
Thank you, sir. All right, folks out there, I hope we all learned something tonight, and I hope you're beginning to learn that you can do something to help end this 88-year-old, terribly flawed and hopeless drug war. I recommend you join the Drug Policy Forum of Texas. Contact them, as Steve said, at www.dpft.org. And more than that, I hope you'll write to your elected officials and demand that they end this war on our children. Make no mistake about it. The children suffer more in prison than they do in using drugs. Think about it, and perhaps soon there will be no more turning away.
No more turning away.
A couple of shout-outs I wanted to do. One was to Debbie Jeffries, who has just undergone some surgery. She hopes to be our guest here in 2 weeks. And secondarily, a shout-out to Richard Lake and his families. I hope God's blessings shine on you guys. Next week, Glenn Urbach will be here. And as I said, Debbie Jeffries will be here to talk about her 8-year-old son who does medical marijuana.
My son has mental illness. He's been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, intermittent explosive disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, name it, you know, the whole gamut of mental illness.
Yes.
And he's been through every medication that there's, you know, been prescribed for him, every combination, and he has been in and out of residential facilities. I had explored medical marijuana. It's been used for years and years for mental disorder. And I had a doctor recommend it for Jeffrey. Within a half hour of ingesting his first part of a muffin that had marijuana in it, he was a new child. Within a half hour after ingesting his muffin, his grip loosened, which was kind of odd. He's always real tense, real serious. And I looked over at him, merging into a different lane of traffic, and I said, "Hey, dude, what's up?" And he says, "Mom," he just got this glow about him. He says, "My head is not noisy. I feel happy." Before, I thought I had the spawn of Satan. I say that loosely, but seriously, life was hell for all of us.
For my producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the Unvarnished Truth.